Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast. Get into the book.
On the POV Book Review.
Kaya 959.
Well, thank you so much for staying with us. It's a Tuesday. I know, believe it or not, it's a Tuesday. When we talk books, and we're going to just, for a minute, we're going to walk away from the Madlanga Commission. I promise you we'll get back to it in good time. But we really had to have this conversation and step out of that for a minute. Jenny Kwantu, I think a lot of people are familiar with the podcast, but I do have the man behind the podcast who's now penned a book, Exploring African Spirituality and Identity, Vusumuzi Nande, who is in studio with us. Very happy to have you in studio. Really appreciate you coming out all the way on such an interesting, cold, chilly, darkish kind of night. Thank you so much for coming.
I'm truly honored. Thank you for having me.
So, I don't want to start with the book. I want to start with the idea of your own journey into, I suppose, exploring your own origins. Mm. Where did that come from?
I think a lot of it, when specifically dealing with my spirituality, I think it started when I left the church.
Mm.
At some point in my life, I was a born-again Christian.
Mm.
And I think when there came a point where my road in that part of my life started to diverge, and I sort of took a decision that should I ever believe in anything again, I want to believe in a way that I don't feel like I'm obligated to partake in particular things. Mm. I told myself that if ever I embark on any spiritual journey, it will be based on, you know, things that I can interrogate and things that I can look into, and not just believing for the sake of believing. That was my, you know, the starting point of me allowing myself to question, because I felt that there were part of my struggles with church was that I was not allowed to ask questions, and by nature I think I'm an extremely inquisitive person, so I felt like in this time round I want to question.
From the book, my sense was that actually the gift was your mother, who allowed you room and space,
yes,
to make a decision.
Yes.
When you decided, no, not today, I'm not going to church.
Yes. You know, that moment, I think I actually took it very lightly when it happened. You know, it was in late high school, you know, and we all go to church, you know, we get woken up every Sunday morning. And I think for a while, you know, I had a very nagging feeling about how I felt misplaced in church. You know, and my mother being a staunch Christian, you know, I was surprised that one morning when I told her that, you know, I don't know why I'm going to church. I really don't know. I don't understand my place in it. And she surprised me with her response when she said that, you know, if you don't know why you're going, then don't go. I think, you know, typically people would be like, you'll grow into it. That's been, I think, the general understanding. But she was like, until you know why you're going, you know, then stop going. I think that really liberated me in many ways. Because, funny enough, I stopped going to church, to my childhood church. But after that, I ended up being a born-again Christian. And I think it was important in that she planted that seed, that you actually do have freedom. You know, you have freedom to explore. I think somewhere in her, she inherently understood that my issue was not God. My issue was just the structure of church. And maybe it was how it was structured, you know, the township churches, you're a teenager, you know, you're a bit rebellious. And maybe she realized, for me, that kind of person I was, I found it too restricting. To not be able to express myself or express my curiosity. Because I remember, even when we were doing like Sunday school, you know, I would have, you know, debates with the teachers about why is this and why is that. And they were like, no, and now you're asking too many questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, questions that I suppose they felt maybe I was questioning too deep.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe sometimes I think it's because I was questioning in a way that they weren't necessarily prepared.
Mm.
So I started then having that clash with, I suppose, structuralism within religion. Yeah,
I found that you dealt with the issue of secular religion in a very elegant way.
Mm.
And I wondered where that wisdom came from, in the sense that even as you saw problems,
mm.
you understood that essentially these are human beings with their own baggage that
yes.
bring themselves to a particular religion.
Mm.
Hence
mm.
we find ourselves with what we, the distinctions between, you know, when you are in a church where the leader is white and with this background, you'll find these characteristics, and in a different environment, black man will have his own ways of seeing things. I thought there was a lot of grace in you
yes.
seeing it that way.
Yes.
That wisdom, where did that come from?
Can I tell you the strangest thing about my relationship with Christianity?
Yeah.
I can honestly say that I fell in love with Christianity after I left church. Mm. And I think it was after I left Christianity that I truly enjoyed reading the Bible.
Mm.
I think to this day, it's the one book that I read more regularly than I read anything else. And I think it's because... When the dogmatic fear-mongering leaves you,
mm.
when you're like, I can read the Bible the same way I read any other book,
mm.
in that I don't feel like there's this thing hanging over me that mm. you have to believe this thing that you're reading.
Mm.
You're obligated. You absolutely have to believe every single word. When that left me, I was like, this is actually in a very amazing book.
Mm.
There is so much wisdom in this book.
Mm.
And with that thinking, I started realizing that there are reasons why we connect differently to different things,
mm.
you know. And where I am now, I feel like there are truly people who absolutely have to go to church.
Mm. Mm.
You know,
mm.
you absolutely have to be Christian for you.
Mm.
Because I feel like different religions or different frameworks of beliefs are built for different people,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, and we will belong to different things because of whatever internal mm-hmm. mechanisms. Maybe it's how your spirit connects,
mm-hmm.
you know, with this particular thing. And I feel like it's like different languages, different belief systems are like different languages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can connect with a certain kind of way of expressing yourself when you are speaking in this particular
mm.
language,
mm.
you know. And but more than anything, I've also come to appreciate the fact that spirituality is a journey,
mm.
you know what I mean. And by that I mean, I now, when I reflect back, I appreciate my time in the church because it laid a certain kind of foundation for me. And when I say that some people need to go back, I feel like in some ways church gives a particular kind of structure
mm-hmm,
to people's
mm-hmm,
lives,
mm-hmm.
especially black people
mm-hmm.
who would have had a very tumultuous,
yeah.
you know, existence.
Life being tough.
Yes.
And we need
yes.
a place
to
you know,
yeah.
mourn and do whatever mm-hmm. the case. You do explore quite extensively the religion versus spirituality. And what I thought was really interesting is just demonstrating to us how dynamic culture is, but in a strange kind of way, when we feel like it, we refuse to believe that culture is dynamic because
yes.
it serves a particular purpose
yes.
at a particular time.
Yes.
But you do that so wonderfully. And why was that important for you?
Sure. That was, for me, understanding the relationship between culture and spirituality for me is foundational in how you see yourself belonging.
Mm.
I think that's one of the fundamental questions
mm.
as to where does culture fit in terms
mm.
of spirituality.
Mm.
And I started asking myself these questions of, you know, when they would say that if you do certain things or don't do certain things, you know, badimo bakwata, you get punished
mm.
and things like that. Within, you know, African frameworks of beliefs, there's also an inherent level of fear mongering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of trepidation, like don't do this, don't do that. And I wanted then to interrogate that. You know, why is it that if I do a particular thing, you know, it angers the ancestors? If I do it this way, because the logic says they are not here anymore, right? They're not of this realm anymore. Why is it that they would be offended by me doing a particular thing? You know, what does it do for them? So this was now the question that I was asking myself. Like, if I don't do this, which is deemed to be, you know, a cultural prescript, what happens in the spiritual realm? You know, what does it, does it affect them? Like, if we are told that, you know, you can't drink water with your left hand, you must drink it with your right hand, and if I do drink it with my left, what actually happens? What does it change? Like, I have this thing where I want to see, you know, even if it was on a TV screen, what happens? Does thunder hit someone? Does someone get sick on the other side? You know, so I wanted to interrogate that and to go as deep as I possibly can to say, you know, what, which one came first? Who gave us, who came up with the rules, with the cultural rules, and make, and not just rules, but who made them?
Like
brought, yes, who brought them together? You know, who made, who linked the two, between the two realms?
So, so how much did you for yourself grapple with the fact that actually it's not true that, you know, these are sacrosanct in that sense, and that there are demonstrations over time where rules were changed just like that overnight? Someone woke up, Shaka, you speak of that, his decision, you know, that no, we don't know, we no longer need to circumcise. And of course there were specific reasons at that time, and then it became a people's culture. Nobody questioned that. But there were moments in history where yes, culture changed overnight. But we don't want to remember that because it must serve somebody.
It must serve. I think one of the most important things for me about this book is that I actually didn't set out to find anything. I didn't set out to prove anything. You know, a lot of the information that's in the book are things that I didn't know, you know, because I think sometimes when a person hears that someone wrote a book on spirituality, one, they think it's like a self-help book where you get like given, you know, bullet points and how-to lists and whatever. I did not set out to prove anything. And that sort of unleashed a very beautiful experience in that I didn't find the things that I was finding, you know, daunting. You know, and now they are sort of conflicting with, you know, what it is that, that I felt, you know, about, no, this has to be true. I didn't go in with that mindset, like, no, this has to be true. This has to be true. And so when dealing with those things about the origins of culture, for me, what was really surprising and affirming in some ways is that the majority of our cultural practices stem from some practical reason somewhere. Right, there was a particular reason why things didn't just happen, you know, because you know, the, we had like the Ten Commandments that came from heaven, kind of a thing. They started somewhere, but now the question for me was, how did something that started here then become a spiritual prescript? You know what I mean? Was there some kind of relationship between this world and the next world? So yeah.
You do then go back into, you know, your own personal journey, your surname being one of those. And maybe tell me about that, in the sense that, to your point about how I did discover, for me, that you were on a journey of discovery rather than this is it and this is what, you know, this is, these are the answers. Your journey of exploring who you are and going outside of the family unit to look for the meanings of who you are. What did that, you know, give you in the end?
Sure. I can tell you, finding out that my name, as deeply, my surname, as deeply Xhosa as it sounds, is actually potentially a colonial surname, was shocking, you know, when you piece together what it means and things like that. And I think for me, it gave me a deeper appreciation of the how dynamic history is. That's the other thing. The one, the most important thing that I think I realized in writing this book is that history doesn't pick sides. You know, there's no sides to this is the good side, this is the bad side. History is, this is what happened. You know, there was a time when my surname didn't exist. Mm. And then there came a time when it came into existence. Mm. And through my research, you know, it was influenced by colonial aspects of architecture, you know, because from my understanding, my surname origins of it come from the word Iklande, which in some Xhosa households means like the main house, which is like a rectangular shape, you know. But when I looked into the history of architecture, black people didn't build in rectangular shapes. And they would say that the Iklande means like four corners, you know, or four sides. And I was like, if we do not build in rectangular structures, and the rectangular structures came with the missionaries, that means that that is the basic origin point of my surname, you know. So for me, it's like it just opens up this whole world of culture is so dynamic, you know. And you can't, I want to say there's almost no sacred cows, you know. If you want to embark on understanding your history, you have to understand that you are going to find things that don't fit neatly, you know, into your own understanding, especially when you look at African history, history in the sense that we tend to want to romanticize, you know, our past. And that's the other thing that I realize, that we do ourselves a deep disservice sometimes when we are sort of, I want to say, pro-black, pro-everything in history, because the truth is that that's not entirely...
It's, you know, checkered everywhere.
It's extremely, it's extremely checkered.
How did you decide when to stop? Because you're an exploring mind, you know. I don't imagine that the book is finished, then you've stopped asking the questions and you've stopped exploring. How did you decide for yourself, okay, I'm stopping now?
Thank God for deadlines.
And editors.
I would not have stopped. I would not have stopped writing. And I actually want to say something in that part of the reason I couldn't stop writing wasn't not just because I was enjoying the writing process, but it also was because of a deep insecurity in that I remember when I first spoke with my publisher, and we're talking about the possible size of the book, word count. I was like, I want to book this thick. And I remember referencing Ubab Kharumutwa's Indaba My Children. I'm like, I want this massive dictionary looking, you know, opus. Because I felt like my insecurity was like, that is the only way people will take you seriously. It has to look like, you know, physically. I wasn't even thinking of the contents. I'm like, I'm going on size alone, you know. And I remember looking at one of my other favorite books, Sapiens. And I was like, I want a book like that. And it was because I felt like if I produced a book that was thin, people like, it's because you had nothing to say, you know. So I kept writing because I was like, no, I'm trying to prove that I do have something to say. And what's funny is that when I turned in my manuscript, my publisher literally cut it in half.
I'm sure.
They were like, no, dude.
I could tell.
They were like, no, dude.
I could tell.
Like, there's like multiple books in one, you know.
I could tell.
So it was really the deadline. And more than anything, the deadline sort of pushed me to embrace my insecurities, to say that, you know, you are trying to cover up your insecurities by keeping on writing and writing and writing, and you're forgetting what the whole objective was, you know. The, a big part of writing, which I'm sure other writers know and people like me who hadn't written before didn't know, is that it is extremely daunting.
Yes.
You know, you are the amount of self-doubt that you are riddled with, you know, the whole time is actually just mind-numbing.
You write like a teacher.
Really?
Yes. You write like a teacher because your storytelling is riddled with the lessons of each and every single point you make.
Yes.
There are. And yes. That's why I could see that someone had to rein you in to say, it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
Yes, we know these pages come from blah, 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 blah. You write like a teacher, which is wonderful, but can be daunting because you, and I now hear you when you say, you know, you had your insecurities. You didn't want to leave anything to chance.
Yes.
Everything had to be thoroughly investigated, yes, researched. So how long did it take you?
I remember telling myself that I want to write an everything book.
Yes.
I was like, I wanted to have absolutely,
you have details
everything,
on everything, everything, yes,
on everything,
yes,
on anything,
yes,
about anything you, yes, ever want to know. That is the, yeah, book.
You're a stickler for detail.
I think, you know, one of the reasons was that I the book has been in the ether for many years, mm-hmm, you know. And funny enough, the book came before the podcast. This is
interesting. This is, that
the book
is
came,
really interesting.
Yes, everything started out as a book.
Really?
Yes. And I can tell you like a bit of how it happened.
Yeah?
So around, I want to say 2013, 2014, I started doing photography where I was documenting ancestral ceremonies, you know, around Ubungoma and things like that. And it got to a point where I was sort of traveling around the country, you know, getting invited, you know, into sacred spaces. And one of the interesting things about doing documentary photography is that you don't spend a lot of time, because it's not a photo shoot,
mm-hmm,
you don't spend a lot of time taking pictures.
Mm.
You spend a lot of time talking to people,
mm,
right? Because these ceremonies happen over, mm-hmm, many days, you know, like in Xhosa customs, it could be over like a week or 2 weeks sometimes. So you spend a lot more time talking. And I remember like I would be sitting with like mostly elders, mm-hmm, you know, we'd be sitting around a fire and they would be explaining things to me like, you know, this is why we do this, this is why we do that. And when I was traveling, I had this little recorder, you know, and I was recording conversations and things like that. And around about that time, I was like, I would actually like to write a book.
Mm.
And the book was me trying to interrogate, more than anything, I wanted to interrogate my own origins, especially in Christianity. Like, I wanted to interrogate. I started reading the Bible. I'm like, I want to understand Christianity. And on the other hand, I'm also listening, you know, to these conversations. So I started researching to write a book. You know, I was researching and I was making notes and things like that. But the recordings were sort of felt to me more fun and more immediate, you know. And I was like, I wish I could, there was a way I could share these conversations with people. And I remember that I started listening to audiobooks. I remember I listened to Malcolm Gladwell's Talking to Strangers, the audiobook. And I remember like how they made this immersive experience, you know, it was different voices talking, and you know, you could hear that they were somewhere. I'm like, I like what I'm experiencing, you know. I'm like, maybe I can look into podcasts and as a way of, you know, sharing this information. And when I made that decision, the book literally just disappeared.
Oh yeah, I get it.
And I like, you know, but then it sort of came around, and I think I started understanding when you are doing guided work, that when you're doing guided work, it's not content. You know, I thought I was doing content. Like, no, you know, you're not doing content. So
yes,
there came a time where it became clear that you need to write the book.
Because this is an experience that you are talking about here, your own experience, and as you're saying, guided work, how do you still your mind? Because it's not, as you said, it's not content. It's not here for entertainment.
Yes.
This is what has to happen.
Yes.
This is you living through this experience.
Yes. Yes.
How do you still your mind?
Sure. I meditate a lot. For me, you know, we have, you know, Umsamo, and people go there, you know, to pray and whatever. For me, Umsamo is a place where I hang out. You know, even at home, they know, like, when I come from work, I need at least about 30 minutes to an hour of just silence, you know. And for me, I've come to appreciate, you know, the communication that you get from silence, especially now. And I think I've realized now that I've sort of been straying away from that practice, and I realized that it's actually making me sick. You know, these days I'm struggling with migraines, you know, brain fog and these things. And I remember even when I was coming here, I'm like, your head is noisy. There's so much noise because now there's so much happening in the world.
you have no idea, and there's always a lot.
It's like you have a TV in your head of blaring things, you know. And when that happens, even internally, I start to feel like I feel very vulnerable, you know, because I don't have that silence, that quiet anymore in my spirit.
What questions remain unanswered for you?
Sure. You know, I don't even consider them questions anymore. I consider them destinations. You know, I've started treating my questions as destinations, because sometimes when you have a question implies a certain lack of knowing or something being wrong or a lack of some sort. Mm. So for me, questions are like points on a map.
Mm.
You know, they point to let's go do this, let's go do that. And more than anything, one of the things that I touched on in the book, but it's something that I'm totally fascinated by is death.
Mm.
And I think some people might feel like it's a bit morbid and things like that. I'm really, really curious about death and us as a people.
Mm-hmm.
I have this nagging feeling that we as black people die wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We don't die right.
Mm.
I think we are not prepared enough for death, because I feel like a lot of our issues is that we have a very conflicted relationship with death.
Mm.
And more than anything is that I feel like because we transition so ill-prepared, we don't become guides that are actually beneficial, because we end up becoming problematic guides, because we still have so many unresolved issues from this side of the world. And when we get to the other side, my belief is that if there are certain things, if they are not resolved now, they become an even bigger problem, you know, when you get to the other side. So for me, I feel like this is a bigger picture for me that I want to investigate. I want to understand that, for example, were there any death rituals for Africans? You know, for instance, within Tibet, you know, there's the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, where there's actually practices where, you know, if there's a person that people know, maybe, for example, in a particular village, there's an elder who's about to transition.
Mm.
There's actually a person who is trained to deal with how to help that person to transition.
Mm.
Like they talk them through the dying phases as the person is transitioning. There's someone who's there who has the training to say, okay, you know, this is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen after you have gone there. This is what's going to happen. And they help them navigate their way to where they need to be. And I feel like that's one of the most important questions for me, is how can we as black people die better?
How much do you think that's attached to how material this world has become, or our lives have become?
I think it's interlinked. And I think because of the relationship, the intertwined relationship between this world and the next world, I feel like it's causing the materiality is also causing issues on the other side.
Yeah.
I feel like our materialism has sparked I want to say a new dimension in the other world, where we end up getting stuck in a particular place.
Yes,
because of our attachment.
You hear a lot of what you'd be told, the spirit world asking for material things.
I'm so bothered by that.
I'm
deeply bothered by you know, I want this, I want that, and I'm like, you don't even have a body. Like you don't have it. Why? And it's not really out of disrespect. Like, what are you going to then? You know what I mean? It's like, what are you going to do? Like, I can't build you a house. Even if I did, you can't get it. You know what I mean? So, but I understand that, you know, there are things that I don't know.
Yes.
And maybe, you know, I just do it anyway. You know, and I have an issue with just do it anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Because you are recognizing the fact that you are on your own journey, how easy or difficult is it to guide your offsprings on their own journey?
So one of the things that I started doing a while back, and I want to implement more formally, is that I turned my itagazelo zams as a guy, I turned them into bedtime stories for my daughter. You know, telling my daughter the story, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to tell you about our people, and I'm like, you know, there was a prince. His name was Ulom. And she's like, ooh. I'm like, wait, I need to tell you. And I'm like, okay. And he lived a long time ago. Was he cute?
Like, yeah, of course.
Okay. Yeah, he was cute. Like, okay. So I'm like, and then what happened? I was like, was he tall? I'm like, bro, can you just listen to the story? Did the girls like him?
Like, you had to humanize the prince, you see?
You know, so I think... When that happened, I realized actually there is a way that we can actually engage kids in the structure of our cultural beliefs and in our spirituality, in terms of making things a bit more practical for them. With my son who is older, I can then have, you know, more solid conversations, you know, to explain to them. I think the one thing that my kids have realized is that we have a very unique belief system in our home, which, you know, does not necessarily correlate with a lot of things that they are seeing outside. I remember the other day, you know, I was speaking to someone and I was saying that we had an event, actually, a relaunch of the podcast. And I was saying that, you know, part of our challenge now as this particular generation or this kind of or this particular group of people is that we don't yet have a language, you know, that we can instill in our kids, because as much as we can say we're practicing African culture, because of our context, we don't necessarily have the right kind of language that, you know, we can just rattle off. And I feel like that's another question that I have, like, okay, how do we develop a language around this for these kids of ours who are going to these, you know, private schools, who are, you know, sort of not indoctrinated, but they're more exposed to Christianity. And we don't want to demonize Christianity and say, no, don't believe in that. How do we help them walk this particular path of, we do live in a predominantly Christian environment, but we are not Christian, but we are not, you know, that particular thing. We are still trying to find, you know, a structure for this amorphous way of belief of ours that doesn't necessarily yet even have a name.
Since there is no final destination with all that you're exploring, in terms of the book itself, did it at least feed something?
Oh, yes, it did. I think for me, the book is my foundation. It's what I wanted to share with people, to say, if I were to say, this is why I believe what I believe. These are the reasons, you know.
And these are the things I'm grappling with too.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. These are the questions that I'm grappling with. And if you were to ask me, why do I believe in this? I can give you like a comprehensive reason. Obviously, I can't give you the experiential part of it, but I can give you like the more practical reasons. Like, this is why I do this, because I understand this is where it came from. But more than anything, I also understand that there are things that should change in culture, and there are things that shouldn't change. And now it's important that we find the essence, you know, of a particular thing. If we understand that things have been, you know, dynamic for over time, you know, when people say we have to do things like the people from the olden days used to do them. My question was,
Which olden days?
Because if you're talking about, you know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200,
very
all
different.
Of these people, very different, you know, in every era. And for me, it has given me a deeper appreciation of the fact that we are also ancestors. What we are doing now is important. So for me, a big part of why I wanted the book out is that it's really more for the coming generations than for us. I want them to know this is what we believed in 2025, or in 2025 was 200 years ago. This is what we believed in. This is why we believed in it. This was the basis of it. This was the cultural and historical influences that created this belief system.
Busmus Nande, thank you so much for coming through. The book is called Journey Kwantu, Exploring African Spirituality and Identity. That brings us to the end of the show. I'll be back tomorrow at 8.
Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.